Science Friday is supported by Progressive. Now, most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. A bit later in the hour, we'll be talking about Hurricane Harvey and adapting to more intense storms in the era of climate change. But first, the idea of quantum entanglement is one of the more head-scratching parts of physics. To me, it is the most head-scratching part of physics. The idea that two entangled particles are somehow linked and instantaneously communicate with each other. It's so mind-boggling that Einstein called it spooky action at a distance. And now a group of mathematicians say that they've proven that the idea of entanglement may be an essential part of physics. Joining me to talk about that story and other selected short subjects in science is Ryan Mandelbaum, science writer at Gizmodo. He's back here in our New York studios. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Ira. How you doing?
I know that you find entanglement as weird as I do, right?
I do. I love entanglement. I mean, it's just crazy to think that these two particles that are, interacted and then get separated somehow share this, weird, crazy relationship between one another.
Spooky action.
Spooky action.
So what did the researchers actually prove? Tell us what they were proving.
Sure. So basically what they said was that any theory that collapses back down into the classical physics that you learned about in high school requires entanglement, not just as sort of a mathematical thing we observe, but more just this innate, this innate property of the universe, and any extension of quantum mechanics or any other theory, be it, mm-hmm. Whatever it has to be, will still collapse into this, we still require this entanglement.
So in other words, we have to make entanglement part of the discussion. Whenever we talk about
the universe.
You have
to deal with it.
Deal with it.
Right, exactly.
So does it make it any easier, though, to understand what entanglement is or how it works?
I've come to sort of the conclusion, I sort of just go to sleep with it at night and forget about it. I mean, it exists and we have to deal.
Yeah. There have been researchers working on practical applications of entanglement, right, for communications in the Chinese. Satellite that... Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. So, there is a satellite in space right now, and they've actually entangled particles between the ground and the satellite with the ideas eventually we might be able to use this link for quantum cryptography, send really well encrypted messages. And the idea is that, if these particles are entangled over this distance and somebody hacks hacks this link, then they would be able to tell the message isn't secure anymore.
I know you hate to move it, but we have to move on to another topic this week. And specifically that astronomers have traced back an old stellar event. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's right. So more than 500 years ago, some Korean astronomers spotted this strange bright star in the constellation Scorpius that disappeared after around 2 weeks. And scientists then went back and looked at the data to try and find the source of this weird stellar event and basically found that a star or a pair of stars that were a little bit outside of the leftover explosion had moved, and they were able to trace these two stars right back into the middle. And it's basically a companion star and a white dwarf orbiting one of another. And then one sucks a lot of matter to the other, and they explode.
Wow, so they actually had to go back and look at old photo plates and things like that, or records, or how did they find that it had moved?
Yeah, they have this plate from 1923, and you sort of put one plate on top of the other, and you see it move.
Wow, that is so. This isn't a supernova. It's a star exploding.
Right,
just a plain old nova.
Yeah, it's like a nuclear explosion on the surface of the white dwarf star.
Mm-hmm. And in other news, let's move on to other news. The FDA has some words about stem cells.
That's right. Yeah, they've been cracking down on a couple of clinics, especially in California and Florida, who have been doing sort of unapproved stem cell treatments for people. Supposedly, you know, they can help in certain ways, but you might have heard of one of these clinics. Actually, there was a case of them trying to treat macular degeneration that led to blindness.
Mm-hmm. So they shut them down, or
they've sent them strongly worded letters.
Letter from the lawyer.
Right.
Letter from the lawyers. But there have been cases where treatments have led to stuff they didn't expect, right? That's why they're shutting them down. We really don't know enough about the effects yet.
Right. We're pretty preliminary. You know, we're really early on in these treatments. There are some things that we're working on, you know, potentially for treating it in Parkinson's disease. There are certain blood and immune system disorders that might be able to see a benefit from stem cells as well.
Tell us about that Parkinson's study.
Right. So it's just actually this past week that they're reporting that in monkeys only, they report they injected stem cells into their brains and they saw sort of an alleviation of the symptoms.
Hmm. Yeah, because stem cells is right on the cutting edge.
Right, right.
Of all kinds of stuff. Finally, there's a let me see if I got this right. There's a warning about your turtle. We're warned, the CDC is warning
right.
us about my turtle. Anybody's not just my turtle.
Just your turtle,
your
right.
Your turtle.
So, yeah, the CDC issued a warning that there was a salmonella outbreak, 37 cases in 13 states since March. There haven't been any deaths yet. And, you know, most people do end up feeling better after a few days. But, you know, they are worried, especially for the young and the elderly. So the CDC recommends washing your hands after playing with your pet turtle and not buying small turtles as pets for your friends.
Yeah, that used to be a thing when I was a kid. Is still a thing buying little turtles in a pet store? I mean, and I guess you can get it off the shell of the turtle, the salmonella.
Right, right.
Don't lick your turtle.
Don't lick your turtle. That's what I always say.
let's talk about what to expect this week. We were talking about Harvey, but there is another hurricane out there, right, that is heading in this direction.
There is.
Irene is.
Not Irene, it's Irma. Hurricane Irma.
Irma.
Right. And
I've got the eyes mixed up. Anyway, the Harvey is an eye, right?
Yeah, it's a strong hurricane right now in the Atlantic that, you know, it's moving. And right now, you know, there's a lot of different tracks that it could take. We're not quite sure if it'll hit Florida or Bermuda or New York.
Right.
But it's strong. I mean, we're talking, I think, as of yesterday, Category 3.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it's been updated yet, but it's really something to look out for.
And something we'll be looking out for next week is the end of the Cassini mission, right? That's going to be very sad.
That's right. We're already sort of crying some tears over at Gizmodo. We're sad about it.
Yeah. Well, we're going to do a special next Friday on that. So thank you. Thank you, Ryan.
Awesome. Thank you, Ira.
Ryan Mandelbaum, science writer at Gizmodo. Now it's time to check in on the state of science.
This is KERA
for WWNO,
St. Louis Public Radio,
Iowa Public Radio News.
That's where we look at local stories and communities around the nation. And as we've seen from Harvey, coastal flooding may become the new normal. But it's not only cities on the seaboard that need a flood plan. Places like St. Louis along the Mississippi are also seeing more floods. Levees are a central part of their flood plan. But how to build them? Well, that's not a straightforward answer. And it's created a levee war in the area. Here to bring us that story is Eli Chen, science and environment reporter at St. Louis Public Radio. Good to talk with you again, Eli.
Hey, thanks for having me, Ira.
Let's talk about what's going on over there. We usually talk about flooding along the coast like we have been all week. Can you give us some context about how flooding has increased in the Missouri area?
Yeah, so flooding has increased along the Mississippi River, and it really depends on what part of the Mississippi that you're talking about. Residents along the Merrimack River near St. Louis, that's a tributary of the Mississippi, they've experienced two major floods in the span of less than 18 months. That's December 2015 and May 2017, and that's, you know, not a whole lot of time to recover. And I've been also reporting, you know, upstream from that area in northeast Missouri, where farmers, you know, along the floodplain, they know there's some risks in, you know, farming that close to the river. But, you know, historically, they've experienced a flood every 15 years. And since 2008, they've actually experienced five pretty significant floods. So that's a huge increase. And, you know, that last year there was a study done by Washington University that showed that, you know, Midwestern floodwater levels are actually increasing 10 times faster than sea level rise. And partly that's due to climate change, but it's also primarily because of, you know, engineering along the rivers.
And when you say engineering, do you mean building of the levees?
Yeah.
How does that contribute? Tell us how that contributes to it.
Yeah. So, you know, the idea of building levees, you know, is to protect, you know, infrastructure like sewage treatment plants, communities, roads, things we value. But increasingly, it's been shown that levees really just protect, you know, what's behind them, as many environmental experts have told me. And what happens when you build levees along rivers is that they constrict them. And I spoke to a geologist at the University of California, Davis, named Nicholas Pinter, who put that pretty eloquently.
You know, it's like an eight-lane highway, and you're constricting the water to a single lane. So it's inevitable that things get clogged up.
So this is what's happening in Missouri.
Yeah, so basically what he's saying is that, you know, these levees kind of push the water up higher, and so they run up higher and faster, and they're, you know, increasing flood damage along these communities.
So actually, I understand that this has created a levee arms race, if you will.
Yeah, so what you're referring to is something called levee wars, where in the past, you know, a landowner would build up a levee to protect his property, but then that would push floodwaters onto, you know, another person's property, so they'd build another levee that's even higher, and it creates this really bad cycle. So the Army Corps of Engineers, what they do is they authorize, you know, levees to be built up to certain levels so that this sort of situation doesn't happen. You know, that the, you know, people shouldn't be built up to, you know, past regulation rather. But where I've been reporting, which is in the Army Corps' Rock Island District, which is a section of the river between central Iowa and St. Louis, a lot of the levees have been shown to surpass regulation. And basically, within the Rock Island District, there are these drainage districts that, you know, maintain and they manage these levees. And if they know a storm is coming, they'll build up a levee higher to, you know, protect, you know, communities from, you know, those floodwaters. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they won't take that height down. And furthermore, they might build up levees to try and get accreditation from FEMA. So that, because their interest is to protect the assets behind the levees. And they want to get this accreditation so that the people, you know, behind those levees don't have to, you know, pay for flood insurance. They can pay for, you know, lower premiums.
I see the levee wars. I see what you're talking about. Thank you, Eli. Have a good holiday weekend.
You too. Thank you.
Eli Chen, science and environment reporter at St. Louis Public Radio in St. Louis, Missouri. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, Dr. Michael Mann is going to be joining us. We're going to talk about Hurricane Harvey. What does what do we know? What have we learned about this and future storms and the cities that may be unprepared for them? We'll discuss all that stuff for the rest of the hour. Stay with us.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. The devastation created by Hurricane Harvey in Houston this week has left all of us with a lot to think about. The destructive power of modern superstorms, the vulnerability of our coastal cities. Even on the other side of the planet, the story is similar. A month of intense rain has created the deadliest monsoon season in memory, killing 1,200 people in South Asia. And while we often hear most about the winds of storms, it turns out that our real focus should be on the water. Harvey's record-breaking rainfall was perhaps the biggest surprise, more than 50 inches in some parts of Houston. Even the National Weather Service said it was beyond anything they've ever experienced. The scale of Harvey's destruction was certainly unanticipated, but was the storm itself unexpected? In the months leading up to Harvey, scientists were warning that because of rising sea temperatures, Houston was due for a severe hurricane. Engineers were warning that the city was unprepared for such an onslaught, which they said was inevitable. My next guest exposed Houston's vulnerabilities to a 100-year storm in a series she co-authored with Kia Collier for the Texas Tribune and ProPublica. And this week, she's been following the events unfolding on the ground in Houston. Nina Satija is investigative journalist and radio producer for the Texas Tribune and Reveal. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks so much for having me.
In the piece you published last year, as a year ago in January, you say it's not a matter of if, but when Houston will experience a devastating storm. How did you know that?
It was what scientists, experts, even public officials and politicians acknowledged. Everyone knew it was coming. You know, these storms, you know, 500-year storms, 100-year storms, they have a 1% chance, a 0.2% chance of occurring in any given year. That sounds like a small percentage, but that means one day it's going to happen.
And what made Houston vulnerable to flood damage from a storm like Harvey?
I would say a couple things. It's a huge, sprawling metropolis, and a lot of unincorporated areas outside of Houston. The city of Houston itself has very outdated flood infrastructure, outdated drainage infrastructure, and also scientists and experts told us unchecked development that was allowed to pave over the prairie land that would have absorbed some, not all, but some of these floodwaters, development inside two reservoirs that were built in the 1940s to protect central and downtown Houston. There are now homes inside those reservoirs. So that was allowed to happen by city, county, state officials.
Interesting. I want to also, joining me for the rest of the hour, bring in Dr. Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State and Director of the Penn State Earth Science System Science Center. He's the author of several books, including the most recently, The Madhouse Effect. Welcome back to Science Friday, Michael.
Thanks, Ira. Always good to be with you.
Thank you. How much were you and other climatologists aware of Houston's risks? Did you single them out, too?
Well, as we just heard from your other guest, it was just a matter of time. And I'm glad that the notion of a 100-year or 1,000-year event, 1,000-year flood, is coming into the discussion, because what we also understand is that climate change is changing those odds. It's literally loading the dice so that those sorts of events that in the past we might have expected to happen once in 1,000 years, now they're happening, you know, once every few decades. Pretty soon, if we continue on this course that we're on, these become interannual events. We get events like this every few years. And so it's impossible to understand the risk that Houston and other coastal cities around the world, as well as in the U.S., face without appreciating the context that climate change has and how that is literally loading the dice towards more of these destructive events.
Nina, has anything changed since your story was published warning about an impending event in Houston?
I would say no, Ira. I mean, one thing I can tell you is, you know, after the devastating Tax Day floods in April of 2016, that was the last floods to really cripple the Houston region before Harvey, which broke all the records, was much worse than Tax Day. After the Tax Day flood, the mayor of Houston, Sylvester Turner, appointed a so-called flood czar. But what that person does, his name is Steve Costello, he's mostly, it's more of a political role, and he acknowledged that to us. He makes house calls, he talks to private citizens who are concerned about their homes flooding. You know, he has some education efforts going on. He doesn't really have much of a budget or a staff. So, no, I would say there's not much has changed. Certainly, the city of Houston and Harris County, where the city of Houston is located, are, you know, in the middle of expensive projects to update some of their outdated infrastructure. But in terms of what scientists and experts say need to happen, smarter development, more buyouts of homes in the 100-year floodplain, you know, more widespread education of newcomers to Houston, that is not happening to my knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Was this story that you wrote about over a year ago, was this the worst case scenario for Houston, or is there something bigger coming?
Well, we published two investigations last year. One was Boomtown Floodtown. The other was Hell and High Water, which was also in collaboration with Reveal. And Hell and High Water talked about what I believe is a worst scenario than what we saw in Houston specifically with Harvey. That, and Hell and High Water talked about a scenario in which a major hurricane would make a direct hit on Houston. And so you would you know, maybe you'd see a lot of rainfall like we did this time, but really what you'd see is that catastrophic storm surge, which is, I like to describe, just a sort of a wall of water coming up into coastal communities. That's the kind of stuff that people need to evacuate from immediately. You know, it could, that's the kind of stuff that could really sweep things away. Of course, we've seen the rain do that too, but that's even in worst case scenario, and that didn't happen this week.
Just one question before you go. With Irma cooking up now in the Atlantic, are people afraid in Houston of something else, of a new threat?
Well, you know, I will say if we get a lot more rain in the Houston region, then we have some big problems. You know, I mean, the bayous have been able to drain. A lot of areas in Houston have been able to drain. The waters have receded. But those reservoirs that I mentioned that were meant to protect downtown and central Houston have seen more water in them than ever before. And they will take months to drain. So if more rain falls on those reservoirs, we've got a big problem. And certainly people are just starting to rebuild. So I think there's a lot of concern. If we see more torrential rain, then the recovery will take even longer than it was expected to originally.
Well, Nina, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Nina Satija, investigative reporter and a radio producer at Texas Tribune and Reveal. Michael, how many other Houstons are waiting to happen?
Well, this is what we're all worried about. And as you've already mentioned, we've got this other storm brewing now, Irma, which is a classic what we call a Cape Verde storm. It forms at a low latitude. It starts out with a lot of spin. If it encounters a favorable environment, as Irma clearly has, very warm, anomalously warm temperatures in the tropical Atlantic, this sort of storm, it's a classic Cape Verde storm. It can become a Cat 4 or Cat 5 monster, and this one seems to have aspirations to strike the East Coast or the southeastern U.S. So we're very worried about this. We, you know, many of us are devastated by what's happened in Houston, and we feel for the people there, and the possibility that we could see another disaster in such short order is, you know, it's troubling to those of us who understand that these risks exist and that they're getting worse.
In fact, you wrote a piece in The Guardian with the headline, "It's a Fact, Climate Change Made Hurricane Harvey More Deadly." Explain how you were able to connect all the dots and what you meant by that.
Sure thing. So there's certain things we know for certain. There is, and we've already alluded to this in the discussion, there's about a half a foot of sea level rise off the Gulf Coast that is attributable to global warming, to human-caused climate change. Now, on top of that, the city of Houston is actually sinking. It's subsiding, and that is due in part to human activities like oil extraction. The city is literally sinking. Sea level, the sea level is rising. It's already risen in that area about a half a foot due to global sea level rise. That means that that storm surge was a half a foot higher than it otherwise would have been. And that means there was more coastal flooding, there was more coastal damage. But on top of that, we also had anomalously warm temperatures, temperatures that were several degrees above normal. And a major part of that is the long-term warming of that region. And that means the ocean surface was warmer, that puts more moisture in the atmosphere. That's one of the most basic relationships we have in atmospheric science. There's a term for it, the Clausius-Clapeyron equation. It's basically just thermodynamics, and it tells us the warmer the ocean surface, the more moisture there will be in the air. The more moisture there is in the air, the more moisture there is to get entrained into a storm like Harvey and produce flooding rainfall. And on top of that, you know, Harvey, unfortunately, is our new perfect storm because all of these factors came together, the next factor being that the storm remained stationary. It remained in place for day after day, and those flooding rains continued to fall on Houston, giving us record flooding several feet over the course of a couple days.
Is there any connection between climate change and the storm sitting there?
So that is the $10,000 question, and scientists are very much debating that proposition. That's not a settled matter, and the links are tenuous, but there is some evidence that, believe it or not, you know, what we say, what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. As the Arctic warms up, it actually changes the what we call the gradient, the temperature contrast as you go from the tropics to the pole. And that temperature contrast is actually what's responsible for the existence of the of the jet stream. So you change Arctic temperatures, and we've seen record loss of ice and record warming in the Arctic in recent years, and we're going to have another very low Arctic sea ice season this year. That's changing these temperature contrasts in a way that we think may effectively be slowing down the jet stream. As the jet stream slows down and it moves north because of the expanding high pressure region, another prediction from climate models, there is the potential that we will get more of these stalled systems. So we can't, you know, definitively say that climate change was responsible for the stationary nature of this system, but that is something we potentially expect to see. And we saw that here. We also saw it with Hurricane Irene some years ago, another storm that led to record flooding in New England. It wasn't that powerful a storm, but it just didn't move off the coast.
So you've made no qualms about saying that climate change made Hurricane Harvey more deadly. You're not saying that it caused more hurricanes, but made it some of them, this one, more deadly. Are scientists, do you think they're being too fussy now about pointing the finger at climate change in the context of these disasters?
Well, you know, frankly, part of why we're fussy is because we know that there are some out there who are just looking to shoot the messenger and get on our case if we, you know, make even the slightest mistake or misframing. And so we're very careful. Scientists are very, very careful. That leads them to be somewhat reticent because they know they'll be attacked by, you know, some of those out there who find the science inconvenient to their bottom line. And so I do think that leads to a reticence among many of my colleagues. There have been articles published about the reticence of climate scientists and how that relates to the attacks on our science. So I do think that leads many of my colleagues to be afraid to connect the dots, even when they're fairly clear. And as I've stressed, you know, we can't say that climate change caused Harvey. There's a good chance it would have happened whether or not climate change existed. But we can point to very specific factors that led Harvey to be more destructive than it would have been. And some of those are ironclad, sea level rise. There's just no question that the storm surge was bigger because of sea level rise. Now, some of the other factors are a little more complicated, but the evidence would favor those factors, too, exacerbating this storm.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. In case you are just joining us, talking with Dr. Michael Mann, author of the most recent book, The Madhouse Effect. We weren't the only flooding in the news this week. I mentioned earlier that there's an incredible monsoon season devastating South Asia with 1,200 people killed there. Where does the science stand on monsoons and climate change? Will they also be getting more intense?
Yeah, you know, the laws of thermodynamics are unforgiving. I start out as a physicist, and I have a deep respect for the laws of thermodynamics. And what they tell us is, all other things being equal, a warmer atmosphere is going to hold more moisture. And the models have been predicting for years that we would see more and more of these extreme flooding events, more flooding monsoons, as well as more flooding associated with tropical cyclones and hurricanes. Now, the interesting thing with the monsoons is that there are a number of different factors that are driving them. And the models actually predict that the South Asian summer monsoon should weaken with human-caused warming. And you might say, well, if the monsoon weakens, doesn't that mean less rainfall? Well, it isn't that simple, because even though the monsoonal circulation and the rising motion that gives us rainfall will weaken a little bit, a warmer atmosphere is so much more moisture-laden. It holds so much more moisture that even a weaker monsoon will be able to wring more of that moisture out of the atmosphere in the form of rainfall. And so we do predict, we have predicted, that monsoon rainfall will increase, and that's what we appear to be seeing. It's very unfortunate, especially when it impacts low-lying regions like Bangladesh, which are already subject to flooding, from coastal flooding, low elevations, likely to experience flooding conditions anyway. And on top of that, you have this very heavy monsoonal rainfall that has fallen this season.
And that seems to be, as I mentioned before, we always talk about the storm surge, you know, when we have a hurricane. Here we had 5 feet of water coming from the sky, from sort of behind, you know, wasn't the storm surge where the water was coming from. Is that the new normal?
Yeah, well, not only is it the new normal, the models say it'll get worse. You know, so there is no new normal. Things get worse and worse if we don't act on this problem, if we don't, you know, move away from what's causing it, which is the continued burning of fossil fuels. And one of the other problems, believe it or not, there's some evidence that the monsoon could become more irregular. It's influenced by things like El Nino. And if the El Nino phenomenon changes, becomes more irregular, then the Asian summer monsoon could become more irregular. So it will literally be feast or famine. We could see an alternation between the extreme flooding rains that we've seen this year, which, you know, as you allude to, has led to a much greater loss of life than what we've seen in Houston. It's truly tragic. But an alternation between that and other years where we have total failure of the monsoon and they don't get the rainfall that they need for agriculture. So that's one of the real worries with climate change are the surprises, are the things that could be in store that are difficult to predict at this point. Uncertainty is not our friend here.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk more with Dr. Michael Mann as we talk about the new normal. I guess it's the new change, because as you say, Dr. Mann, the normal keeps changing what the new normal is. We're going to talk about the floodwaters, flood-resilient buildings, because people are starting to take in the new normal and actually build buildings here in New York City that will be resistant to flooding, about new technologies to do that. And what to expect now that the floodwaters are receding in Houston. What's in that water? How dangerous is the water that's remaining there? The chemicals, the bacteria? We'll talk about it after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about Hurricane Harvey, the deadly monsoons in South Asia, and the impact of climate change on severe weather around the world. My guest, Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State, author, co-author of the recent book, The Madhouse Effect. The remains of Harvey are still being felt as intense rain inland now, but there's another storm brewing in Houston, and that is a public health crisis brought on by contaminated floodwater. Here to tell us about that is Rachel Noble, professor at the Institute of Marine Sciences, University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. You've talked on our show before about how bacteria in the ocean can make us sick. And now with a hurricane, if you have a big storm surge, then all that stuff is now in the floodwater. What should be the most thing we're concerned about?
Well, absolutely. And as you've already noted in the show, it's not just the storm surge, but it's the rain from the sky, as it's been described. And that together really creates the floodwaters serving as a way to inundate infrastructure and any pipes or any systems that we use, a whole range of systems to transport waste from our homes and businesses to, you know, desired locations like a sewage treatment plant, and in some cases, in many areas of Texas, still homes functioning with septic systems. If those systems become inundated with the floodwaters, first of all, they're just simply not functioning the way that they were designed. They're inundated. The floodwaters become are capable of getting into those systems just by standing water, and also by cracks or openings in the pipes, or just naturally through stormwater conveyances. And so that makes it difficult for the sewage treatment plants to function the way that they were designed. And then secondarily, the same process can go the other direction. So those materials found, those viruses and bacteria found in sewage and in human waste that's part of a septic system type treatment, those can become part of the floodwaters. And so when people go outside and are faced with a rescue or some contact with the floodwaters, basically what happens is that they have the possibility of ingesting or even just coming in contact with either chemicals or some of these bacteria that can, in particular, make people susceptible to wound infections.
I guess just walking on your soggy lawn now, even if the flood waters have retreated.
Absolutely. That's one thing about these systems, is that they come through here in eastern North Carolina with Superstorm Sandy and with the ensuing weeks afterwards. Certainly people are dealing with large-scale issues, life-threatening issues. But then in addition to that, once the floodwater subsides to the level of the ground, and people say to themselves, okay, that floodwater is gone, For many purposes, that high groundwater can still have the same effect for weeks and months, actually, after a storm. In some of the barrier island systems during Superstorm Sandy, for example, we were seeing those effects and seeing groundwater pumping that needed to be done 3 weeks, 4 weeks after the storm event itself.
Is there one pathogen, one virus we should be most worried about that could turn into an epidemic?
Well, one in particular that people read about commonly, and for people out there that have children, they've almost everyone has heard of it, and that's norovirus. So norovirus is prominently found in sewage simply because it's almost often the case that that the norovirus are present in at least a portion of the population. And so when you mix it all together, I know it's an awful graphic, but mix it all together, those viruses become part of the sewage treatment system. Now, most of our treatment systems in the United States function quite well with ozone and with UV treatment to reduce the numbers of noroviruses in sewage or other types of viruses and bacteria. We do a great job in terms of, you know, comparison globally with our sewage treatment. But, you know, really, norovirus, it's one of those things you hear, you read in the news with the recent outbreaks in the food safety world for Chipotle. It really only takes one of those viruses to get to the right place to cause its problem. And then from there, if it's a child or if it's someone in the family that you have to then tend to, the rate of secondary infection is very, very high. As a matter of fact, terrible for me to even mention it, but there's a number of cases being seen at UNC Chapel Hill at the moment of norovirus. It's just a contagious viral pathogen, and the person-to-person transmission of that particular viral pathogen is pretty high, and it's pretty difficult to contain.
Wow.
Can be a real problem. So the problem there is that you really don't have to come in contact with a lot. You just can ingest some contaminated water, and there's the potential for illness.
You know, Michael, this we hear about a lot is that the incidence of disease is changing by climate change.
Well, that's right, and that's one of the important dimensions when it comes to the climate change impacts of these sorts of events and coastal flooding in general. There's a bacteria, I forget the name, I think something like Vireo.
Vibrio, yep.
Yes, thanks.
Yep.
Thanks. And which my understanding was that that has also been found in the cesspool that is now the waters that have flooded Houston. And interestingly enough, there was an article no more than a year ago published in one of our leading journals, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, that found that that particular bacteria is on the increase along the east coast of the U.S. in concert with flooding events along the east coast of the U.S. Because of warming. Warming waters actually provide a more favorable environment for that particular bacteria. In this case, in the case of Houston, we have this toxic brew of biological contamination of the waters and chemical contamination. And some of the chemical contamination is a result of sort of, lax regulations when it comes to pollutants, industrial pollutants. And sadly, within the last few months, we have seen many of the regulations that had been put in place to ensure protection of water quality under these circumstances. We've seen a lot of those regulations taken, obliterated. And so now, you know, we're going to potentially see more of this sort of toxic mix in concert with events like Harvey.
Dr. Noble, I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us today. Very informative.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You're welcome. Rachel Noble, professor at the Institute of Marine Sciences, University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And one of the major issues as we head into an era of unprecedented storms is our failing infrastructure in cities vulnerable to these events. Our buildings, our levees, we're talking about them, our sewer systems, they're not built to withstand such an impact. And here in New York, Superstorm Sandy flooded high-rises along the rivers and coasts, and that storm was a wake-up call for some developers who went back to their drawing boards to design and construct buildings that could be flood-resilient. Resilient is the new word we're going to be using a lot now. And one of those developers who heard and answered the call is my next guest, Simon Koester, principal with the JDS Development Group in New York. but joins us from Crested Butte, Colorado at KBUT. Still with us is Michael Mann. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much, Ira. Good afternoon.
Simon, your company built a flood-resilient building here in New York over on First Avenue. That was in response to Hurricane Sandy?
That's right. We were just in the process of purchasing the land when Hurricane Sandy occurred in the fall of 2012. And we were in the unique position of seeing all the problems that Hurricane Sandy had caused firsthand. And so as we were assembling our design team, our architects, our engineers, our landscape architects, everyone had just lived Hurricane Sandy in different ways. Some people couldn't get to work. Some people couldn't get home. Some people didn't have power. And so as we started designing the American Copper Buildings, everybody brought their own personal experiences to the problems we needed to solve. And the really straightforward process that we went through in the design was that everybody understood the problem so perfectly. And that's why we were able to get through design and work through with the city and utilities to really create a product in New York that just doesn't exist yet.
Yeah, some of the interesting things you came up with is you moved the vital equipment that's usually in the basement, you moved it up out of the way of flooding, right?
Yeah, that's right. So one of the main problems of Hurricane Sandy was, of course, that all the basements, cellars, and sub-cellars were flooded completely. And most buildings have all of their critical infrastructure in the basement. So we took everything that's typically there, moved it up to the second floor. And of course, that's very straightforward for some systems and some not so much. We worked with Consolidated Edison, the power utility in New York, to move and build a unique power transformer system in the building to keep it out of the street. And then, of course, we built a generator plant inside the building as well, well above the flood zone, that went way beyond any sort of code requirement to power outlets, refrigerators, pumps, elevators, so that really in the event of extended power outages, the building remains habitable.
So you could survive for how long then? A week, something like that?
So as long as there remains natural gas service to the building, there's enough generator power to keep it habitable indefinitely.
And are other architects and builders doing this?
So people are certainly doing it now. These things have been adopted into the new New York City building code in what is known as Appendix G, where a lot of the national guidelines have been adopted to ensure that at a mere minimum, the life safety requirements for residents are met even in a flood condition, which of course the life safety condition, or excuse me, the life safety requirements used to be predominantly for fire, and now they're also for flood. So every developer has to meet those basic code requirements, but many are going above and beyond to deal with what we all saw so vividly in 2012.
I understand that you even, in terms of resilience and recovery, the lobby of your buildings are made to be recovery resilient.
Yeah, that's exactly right. From the very beginning, we knew that there were parts of the building that under any circumstance absolutely must stay dry. Those are the things that were pulled out of the flood zone. And we also knew that almost no matter what we did, certain things were going to get wet, like the basement and the lobbies. Those have to be on grade or below. So we built lobbies that are built predominantly of stone and glass so that the cleanup effort after the fact is as minimal as possible. And then in the basements, for example, where most buildings in Hurricane Sandy spent days, if not weeks, pumping the water out of their basements, we actually have a pumping system built into the basement to remove water after a major flood event, because it's just something that no matter how hard we try, eventually will get wet.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Dr. Michael Mann and also with Simon Koster of JDS Development Group in New York. Michael, does it worry you that people might be diverted from taking proactive action against climate change if they think, hey, we could just build a more climate-proof building?
Yeah, well, the reality is that we are going, if we're going to tackle this problem, we are going to need to engage both in mitigation, which is to say we've got to stop doing the thing that's causing the problem, that is causing the planet to warm, that is causing climate change, which is the burning of fossil fuels. We have to get off fossil fuels. We have to incentivize renewable energy. We need to lower our emissions. We need to meet our obligations under the Paris Agreement. And at the same time, unfortunately, there is a certain amount of additional climate change, a certain amount of additional warming, and perhaps, unfortunately, several feet of sea level rise that is already baked in, that we can't stop. It's going to happen simply from the greenhouse gases that we've already put into the atmosphere because of the inertia of the climate system. It's like a locomotive. If you slam on the brakes, it doesn't come to a screeching halt. It may go another mile down the track before it stops. Thus it is with climate change and warming. So we're going to have to do both. We're going to have to adapt to the changes that are in store by making smarter decisions about where we build, investing in seawalls. Ultimately, we will have to, in some cases, literally retreat, gracefully retreat from our shorelines as sea level rise continues. We're going to have to engage in adaptive measures while doing everything we can to mitigate the problem. And I have to say what's troubling is the reversal with our current administration of policies that were intended to do both. Under the previous administration, that were intended to stem the problem at its source, which is the, you know, getting off fossil fuels, incentivizing renewable energy. And we've also seen, and ironically, just weeks before Harvey struck, we saw the Trump administration revoke policies that had been put in place by the Obama administration to require that communities in their coastal planning decisions take sea level rise and climate change into account.
Mm-hmm. But Simon Costa, you folks don't care about the new regulations. You see it already self-evident that these are the things you have to do.
So when we first started, the new regulations actually weren't in place yet. Working with the city and the utilities, we ended up going in some ways very much beyond the new code. But to your earlier question of does this, if people can live in places where climate change is not a problem, does that mean they're not thinking about climate change? And I think the answer is no, that people are thinking about it, because as these events happen more frequently and the coverage and information about all these events and why they happen and their overall impacts become more universally known, people are asking more questions. And we see this whether we're in New York or Miami, or whether we are talking about a retail space or a condominium. Hmm. And this is front of mind for just as much buyers as it is renters. So I think the climate change conversation is coming to the forefront. And it's not just about making sure they can live in an insulated place from it. It's certainly the two components of being safe but doing something about it. But people are certainly more aware than they used to be.
I'm going to leave it at that because that's about all the time we have. But we will be revisiting this. I want to thank Dr. Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science, Penn State, Director of the Penn State Earth Science System. I keep getting that wrong. Penn State Earth System Science Center. He's the author of several books, including The Madhouse Effect. Simon Costa, principal with the JDS Development Group in New York. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Ira.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. One last thing before we go. Annie and Ella from our podcast Undiscovered are teaming up with Flora Lichtman. Remember Flora? Yeah, from Gimlet's Media's Every Little Thing, to take New Yorkers behind the scenes of scientific discovery. And you can join them at Caveat in New York City on September 14th. For an evening of the untold stories of science and your chance to guess meteorites from media wrongs. Get it? There will be prizes. Tickets and information at sciencefriday.com/events, sciencefriday.com/events. Charles Berquist, our director, senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alex Lim, Christy Taylor, Katie Haller. Our radio intern is Shusmita Patka. Rich Kim is our technical director, and our Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz are engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. Have a great and safe holiday weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.